You are who you are. And the experiences that you go through aid and assist in shaping you, and also aid and assist in how you navigate through things and why. And as much as you are your choices, you are also the second chances that you are provided to do things. And I very much believe that as well.
This week's guest is Jennifer L. Williams, our first guest of Series 3, a leading thinker and advocate for diversity, equity, and inclusion. During this open, honest, and expansive conversation, Jennifer discusses why diversity, equity, and inclusion must be foundational in reimagining how we work, how we build teams, and move forward to a more equitable society. In part one of this two-parter, Jennifer discusses growing up as an only child in DC with her loving but overprotective Panamanian mother, navigating the highly controlled home environment by immersing herself in writing and reading. This ignited her inner creativity that set her on a path to focusing on becoming her best self. Jennifer reflects on the other foundational influences in people growing up, on gratitude, anger, and being responsible for one's own happiness, and the second chances life gives us. Jennifer eloquently expresses the experience of establishing herself as a young black woman in corporate New York, recounting her mother's sage words, "You have to be twice as good to be considered half as competent." At the end of part one, Jennifer discusses her experience of moving to New York and the caring, safe environment she was welcomed into. In part two, we dive into Jennifer's career and journey to diversity, equity, and inclusion. I hope you enjoy the vitality and vigor of Jennifer L. Williams. Jennifer, welcome to the Impossible Network podcast.
Thank you so much.
It's wonderful. And we always have to give a shout out and a thank you to the person that connects us. And we, in this case, it's Keith from WearWorks.
Yes, Keith Kirkland from WearWorks, a dear friend. I am so grateful for him having made this connection. Very much a believer of WearWorks. WearWorks.co, if you don't know it, please go there. Aiding and assisting those with sight impairments and other issues to be able to navigate their spaces better and feel more empowered in spaces.
And I saw that they just launched their new set of bands today. I saw them on Instagram.
Yes, yes. And I'm so proud of them. Continued success to WearWorks. Definitely, they're going to take the world by storm. They already are.
Definitely. Well, that's cool. So again, thank you to Keith Kirkland for doing that. So before we get into talking about your life, and I've described you looking at your background and your LinkedIn and what you've some of your videos and your website as an organizational change agent. If that's not the right best description for you, then we can fix that later. But before we get into talking about where you are and the journey you're on and where you're going, we'd love to start with understanding where you've come from and the journey to where you are today. So perhaps we could maybe start where you were born. And I believe, if I'm right, it was Washington, D.C.
You are absolutely correct. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. I want to be clear, not in Maryland, not in Virginia, actual D.C. Occasionally, you have to explain this to people. I was born at Howard University Hospital, born and raised in uptown Washington, D.C., so Northwest. The line between DC and Silver Spring, Maryland was literally a street away. So I would usually like run across the street and say, I'm in Maryland, then run back and be like, I'm back in DC because you're young and this is the fun thing to do. Raised by my mother, Dr. Celia Maxwell. The childhood in DC, I'm laughing. I tease my mother a lot now. She was an extraordinarily overprotective mother. Very overprotective to the point where my elementary school, Shepherd Elementary, was literally three blocks away, down a hill, up two hills, and then there was a school. And I was not allowed to walk to or from school by myself.
Until what age?
No age. I did not walk to and from school for elementary school by myself. Yeah. And I tease her now. I had a nanny or a housekeeper that was responsible for waiting for me so I could leave and then walking me to school. And like sometimes she'd make the concession and like wait by the sidewalk so I could walk in and save some level of my dignity so I didn't get teased horribly. But like, yeah, there's nothing cool being in fifth grade and sixth grade and having to wait for an older Latina woman to walk you back down three blocks, okay? So it definitely was not the best time for my social life. But again, you know, you're in sixth grade, you're in fifth grade, it'd be okay. I then attended Alice Deal Junior High School, had a blast going. I remember that was my first time taking the Crosstown bus. to and from. Mm-hmm. So I felt very accomplished because I was taking the bus, and then the same housekeeper was responsible for riding the bus with me to and from.
So you didn't have a school bus?
No. For Deal, they used an MTA bus and just transformed it into one of the buses that would take us to and from the junior high school. So you can imagine how much of a hit my social life took being in seventh grade and trying to eke out my own level of autonomy and still needing to wait for the housekeeper to get on the bus to leave.
Why was your mother so protective?
Mom is very much one of those individuals. And again, this is DC. This is DC in the 80s and 90s. There were various things that were happening in DC. My mom worries to worry, however. And I know this about her. And I also know by virtue of both her clinician brain and her mom brain, if she takes out every threat in the equation and it doesn't exist, there's then no need to worry about not being able to control the environment. And in a very real way, part of me utilizes that same line of thought in how I do what I do. But I also don't have a kid. I have a dog. So there's a completely different situation. Rocket might not be happy right now, but Rocket isn't being shamed by other doggy neighbors who are like, your mom doesn't let you walk out by yourself. So I very much believe it was that. It was that. So, you know, it was dicey, but I remember and continue to utilize humor as a gateway or portal to introduce myself to people. One, because I find there to be a level of humor in everything. And two, it's a great icebreaker. And I have no problem making myself a little bit goofy. And I also don't believe in the tenet of strangers. Like, literally, they're just people I haven't met. I will talk to anyone or anything or anybody. I do not care. It's like, hi, you're in my space. Let's talk. People are just like, what? I'm like, yeah, you're here. I'm here. Let's have a conversation. It just feels authentic and organic. After going to Deal for junior high, I transitioned into Duke Ellington School of the Arts, which is an arts high school and also in DC. My art of choice was theater. Duke Ellington is a relatively small high school, so I believe there might have been 400 students total in the entire school. But it was wonderful from the perspective of being able to immerse myself in my craft and my passion of choice, which is theater, and still is a dear love right now. My high school trajectory, however, got a little differentiated. I was accepted into, let me go backwards to go forward. In DC, there's a program called High Skip. It allows any person who is in high school that has completed most of their credits to attend one college course of their choice in any of the surrounding universities. So American, Georgetown, GW, Howard, any of those. Howard, however, had a tenet on theirs that if you did high skip through them, you had to become a full-time freshman. So I'm having this conversation as a 16-year-old about to begin her senior year, understanding that I could do this high skip program and knowing that I could either take one course elsewhere, I could become a full-time freshman at Howard University.
What is high skip?
High skip, HISCIP was the acronym. I cannot recall what it stands for, but that was the acronym for the name of the program. And I was like, well, hell, I love a challenge. Obviously, I want to do Howard. Obviously, I want to be a full-time freshman and a senior at the same time. Why wouldn't I do that? Becoming a full-time freshman at Howard necessitated the need to live on campus. Again, I've explained my mother to you. And I was very clear that while this was an amazing opportunity, there was no way in hell my mother was going to say yes to this. So you can imagine my surprise when I was accepted into the high skip program at 16 and moved onto campus that summer to begin the summer intensive that was to begin my both freshman year in university and my senior year at Duke Ellington School of the Arts. To this day, I still don't understand what made my mother say yes. My uncle, may he rest in peace, after I had a conversation with my mother, she was like, you know that he convinced me to do this. He was the reason why I allowed you to do this because nothing else makes sense. The way that you are, I was like, there's no way you're going to actually let me live on a college campus? How? And to be clear, my mother works at Howard Hospital, so it isn't as if it would be difficult to see her. But just knowing how my mother was, I was like, this is college. This is a whole different ballgame. I'm a pseudo adult and you're allowing this? This is amazing. So beginning university at 16, living on campus at 16, I finished all of my college courses during the day. And then I would return to Duke Ellington in the afternoon to finish up my arts credits that were outstanding. You can also understand how that would change the narrative of a senior year when you are actually a freshman in university. Things that would matter and matter a great deal just didn't matter as much. Prom, I was like, I'm in college. Like yearbook photos and like senior skip day. It's like, I'm in college. But I mean, okay, I guess this is great. Yay.
I'm interested to understand when you were growing up with this level of, I don't want to say control, but control by your mother.
Yeah.
Were you sort of aware of this cosseting and this, that you were being in any way constricted and unable to express?
Absolutely. I'm an only child. I remember being very angsty. I found journals from that time. My mother is smothering me and I am not allowed to be my own person. I'm 11. I'm not allowed to be my own person and explore the world the way that I want to. Like, you know,
How did you express your rebellion?
I wrote a lot. I wrote a great deal. I read a lot. I think that in order to navigate through that time, there was a level of escapism, and I was able to escape through reading. I was able to escape through writing, right? I also lived vicariously through friends. One, I'm an only child, and two, I'm surrounded by friends who like could do any and everything in my mind because I couldn't do some of these things. Hindsight is definitely 20/20. I understand in real time, you know, there's a conversation now around why certain people, like especially now, you won't allow kids to go to certain people's houses, right? Or there are just certain things that you don't do. And I understand that now as an adult, the need to be cautious and careful with children, especially the narrative now where people, you know, young people getting abused or things happening to them and not necessarily having either the language or the bandwidth to explain what has occurred to them and not being put in that precarious situation to begin with. Like, I get it now. And I think that that was also part of my mother's fear, but it was difficult to navigate. I just wanted to be like everyone else. I just wanted to be free and like, you know, eat Cocoa Puffs. Oh, there was also no sugar cereal. I was raised vegetarian.
What type of clinician was your mother?
My mother is still an AIDS and infectious diseases doctor and also the vice provost for women at Howard University. And she's added a couple of other sparkly, glittery, dazzly situations to the end of her name as well. Which wow. means I essentially either am responsible for curing cancer or, you know, fixing the hole in the ozone layer to be on some level of comparison with her. No pressure. None whatsoever.
So growing up with that, there is something interesting going on there with obviously a parent. We've interviewed other people that had high performing parents.
Yeah.
It's always interesting to look back at their backstories and what their parents and their upbringing was like.
Absolutely.
To understand why they were the way they were and their projections of their expectations on you.
Yes.
So that's one question I want to understand a little bit about.
Okay.
Where she came from.
Yes.
But also, if you think there might be some element at play in there between how she was guiding you, let's say, in a kind way, conditioning you, protecting you, whether that rebellion, that quiet rebellion you had, gave you a sense, affected your journey to take you in a direction where you actually represent people and people's rights, people that are denied rights. And if that denial that your mum imposed on you has had an impact.
I've never thought of it in that nature, but I definitely believe that to be true. Mm-hmm. Even when I was younger, the ability to march to the beat of my own drummer, as overprotective as my mother was, there was always very much a desire to ensure that anything I was interested in, I had access to.
Right.
So, you know, when theater became a thing, it was like, okay, then you're going to be the best theater person you can be. This is where you go. This is the training you get. This is who you have to interact with. There were the tickets to the Kennedy Center. I know the ceiling like the back of my hand. I go so much taking in theater, taking all of that in. But it's also the understanding that in the belief of becoming your best self, I very much now believe, and I think the narrative for children as well has changed, right? The understanding that we're now looking at children being their own people and being able to say no and having more of an understanding that when you're wrong as an adult, you still need to apologize to your child as opposed to this is just the way things are, you'll be fine, right? I very much believe in the baseline of not being able to, apart from now being older and understanding why my access and proximity to certain things was not given to me, because too much given too soon can create a different narrative as well. I also understand the fire that burns when you're not able to do something and the creativity that you have to employ to be able to get it out somehow, right? I'm grateful for, you know, there was also no TV. So this is also the reading and writing portion.
Wow.
I got an hour of TV on the weekends. Yeah. So there was a lot of NPR. I was the nerd that heard everything.
You must have had friends going around to their houses, and they must have been coming to your houses.
It was grandpa. It was amazing going to friends' houses. I was like, you get to eat sugar cereal. Cereal with sugar in it, honestly, and watch TV. I remember binging for hours. It's also a running joke now. I have a deep love of animation. And my mother basically says that my love of animation is because she took it away from me when I was a child and didn't allow me the opportunity to like binge on cartoons and all of those other things. And I think she might be right. But yeah, I'd go to other people's houses and I'm just like, this is how you live. Wow. You have a TV in your bedroom. You can watch it whenever you want. Oh my God. Like it was mind blowing. It was so mind blowing. But I will also say that nature versus nurture, I have a home. I have one TV. There's no TV in my bedroom. There's very little electronics in my bedroom. And that's kind of how I navigate through life. So thanks, Mom. You did that. Thank you. In regards to my mother's upbringing, my mother was born and raised in very much abject poverty in Panama, in Colón, Panama. She came over to the States after my grandmother, may she rest in peace, came over to the States as a house cleaner and then brought my mom over shortly thereafter. My mom worked hard, got through high school, got through university, decided that she wanted to be a nurse, went to nursing school, and by both an interesting twist of fate and individuals who wouldn't take no for an answer, found herself on a track to become a doctor. Went to Columbia Medical School, and that is all she wrote. Has had an amazing trajectory, has worked in the U.S. Senate, has had the opportunity to work alongside presidents, has aided and impacted policy as a thought leader, and speaks on various topics that have to do with both infectious diseases and how health and healthcare align with Black people specifically, mm-hmm. and women as well. Extraordinarily proud of who my mom is and also how my mom is.
This is the thing that I struggle to understand, the logic in American immigration policy, and particularly around the Dreamers. We interviewed Cristina Jimenez, and you look at the what you described as your mother and the impact that she's had as a doctor, a researcher, and from her background. Why would you, as a country, if you want to remain the most forward-thinking, the forward-looking, the fastest-moving, the most innovative nation on the planet, you have to invite in the most unlikely array of people to bring together that diversity and activate it. And it's the history, it's the culture, it's the DNA of the country. And we're at this point where you're going, why? Why would you reverse that trend? Why would you inhibit yourself? And that's what's happening. And what you just described, your mother, is just a perfect example to frame what we're going to talk about in terms of diversity and inclusion.
I'm one of those people. It's interesting, right? The immigration debate is always one that stirs up a lot in me. My grandmother did it the right way, right? My mother did it the right way. They filed for citizenship. They got their citizenship. Then I was here, which also makes it very interesting to me to think if I decided to just drop into anywhere. I now want to be a citizen of France. Mm-hmm. France wouldn't just accept me. I'd have to go through that process. Or Brazil, or, you know, even of Panama, or of any of these places, I would have to go through a process to do those things. And yet the American ideal and standard and dream is built on the individuals making it great and the openness and acceptance of difference to get us here, which is why the current pervasive nature of this nationalistic push is so disconcerting, mm-hmm. because it hurts us instead of helping. Mm-hmm. I also understand the need, right, to follow rules and to do things and to not accept anyone doing anything by virtue of it having been done. But I also understand the richness that we receive by virtue of being inclusive. Mm-hmm. And it definitely does filter into the work that I do now.
Yeah, it's so strange. I remember a few years ago watching that. There's a wonderful documentary series about the history of New York, and just watching that and seeing the sort of the different, through the different generations, different immigrants coming in and how they created the cultural diversity and nuances of the city that make it such a wildly exciting and powerful place, and the energy of the city. And for a nation built on immigration, it's just confounding.
So my mother and my father divorced when I was zero. So basically I was born and then they were divorced. My mother remarried when I was three. My stepfather passed when I was nine. My stepfather, Paul J. Bacon, is very much the reason why I approach the world and my place in the world in the way that I do. He was an architect and he was very, very much a girl dad. Uh-huh. Right? And so even though I wasn't his, I was his. And he made every point an opportunity to ensure that I knew that I was special and important. And having that as a basis for a very solid foundation from a man and what I needed and what to expect, I'm grateful for. Because so many women don't receive that. And so many girls growing up don't receive that. So I'm so grateful. It was the part. I remember, and I still have, like, this is old school dot matrix printer, like old school. You had to line up the dots on the side. He would make me little banners. Jennifer is amazing. Jennifer is love. And I still have them to this day. I'm actually looking at a pair of his glasses that I keep on my bureau to just remind me of that level of grounding and care. My real father, Johnny L. Williams, also a doctor. So I'm surrounded by these people, which is another reason why I don't to be one. Sorry, mom and dad, is very much still in the picture. And I'm grateful for our renewed relationship in my older years. I know that growing up with an understanding of feeling a bit untethered after my stepfather passed and then trying to navigate my way and honestly feeling a bit angry and not necessarily having the type of relationship that I wanted to have with my father. And then both being older and a little wiser and understanding both with me work and internal work. That's a shout out to Landmark for the ability to aid and assist in the level of transformation and understanding that you yourself are responsible for your own happiness. Getting to understand and know my parents from an adult perspective. People do the best that they can with what they have at the time. And I truly do believe that. And I remember for a very long time being upset because I didn't have the type of relationship that I wanted with my father. And it was always, you didn't try, you didn't lean in, you didn't want. And there was very little ability on my end to look at, but what were you going through? How are you navigating these things? Now on the other side and being an older person, ensuring that I'm able to navigate this space with a bit more grace and understanding, right? You are who you are. And the experiences that you go through aid and assist in shaping you and also aid and assist in how you navigate through things and why. And as much as you are your choices, you are also the second chances that you are provided to do things. And I very much believe that as well.
When did you do the Landmark course?
Oh man, I put so many people through. I think I put Keith on it. Like, Landmark was about 8 years ago. I remember being pushed to do it by a friend and I was like, I don't do pyramid schemes. I don't want to do one legal. I don't understand what this is. This is very strange to me. She was like, just come to one of these forums and understand what it's about. And I was like, okay, I'll come. But I remember giving her a very clear side eye, like, if this is a cult, we're not friends anymore. And I'm going to tell my mama about I don't do cults. This is very strange. And I remember going in and instantly feeling the energy and the vibration in the room go up. And also being clear that I was surrounded by people that were so self-aware, it was unreal. Like the ability to go, all of these things happened to me, but here I am and I'm still able to do this and navigate this way and make these choices. Because just because that happened doesn't mean that that has to be my story. I was like, you got shot 4 times in the face. You're allowed to be angry at the person that shot you 4 times in the face. You're not? Huh. I like to think that I am very wise and I've gotten to a level of nonplus. I'm like, no, you person have gotten to this level that I apparently need to get to. And so I remember hearing that and being like, okay. And then I was like, I'm in. And they're like, it costs this amount of money. And I was like, I'm sorry. I live in New York and I have ramen noodles for dinner often. I don't think you understand that, but thank you. And they're like, don't worry about it. Sign up. The money will come. And I remember very much thinking, and I probably said it. I was like, white person, maybe that's how the world works for you. But I don't and they were like, the money will come. Just sign up for it. And I was like, well, I need to ensure that there is an opt-out clause because I understand the money coming, but I also understand rent being due. So we'll figure this out. But also I want to make sure that I'm not on the hook for something. The money came. I took the course. The level of radical accountability that I received.
What was your reaction when money did come into your life to allow this to happen?
I was incredulous. I'll be very honest. Yeah. It made no sense. And I remember I was like, this white hippy dippy, what the, I mean, I'll go for it if this is what we're doing, but I don't understand that life works this way for me, but okay, sure. If that's what we're doing now. And then the money came and it was, I remember it was the exact amount that I needed. And I was like, okay, so you know how you ask for signs and you get them and you're like, can't really argue with that. if that is what and how we're moving right now. I remember it was a check. I got a check for something refunded, like a very, very long time. One of those, like, we owe you this amount for not having completed this order or something. I'd either ordered something or was owed something. It didn't come. And I also, this is, I'm terrible at checking my mail. So this is also a note to me, Jen, check your mail. But this is also like a longstanding issue. I went to check my mail and there's like this nondescript envelope. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess. And I open it and it's like a check. And I was like, that's the exact amount I need for Landmark.
You're not the first person that I've heard tell stories similar to this that have done similar courses like Landmark. That's why I asked you.
Because yeah.
There does seem to be a pattern.
It was unreal to me. And I was very much like, really? Okay, I guess. But really? This is what's happening? Okay, but really? And so I paid for it and I went. And I remember the very first night, I'm also, if you couldn't tell, I'm not shy. Also understanding the fact that there are a lot of people there and everyone wants to have the opportunity to speak. And they would only choose a couple of people. So on the off chance that I would get chosen, you know, I raised my hand. And I got chosen. And this was night one. And I remember having an issue at work. Something was happening. It's very dynasty. Someone's trying to destroy you. Why are you in my cubicle? All I want to do is good work. Because everything's real in your life when you're young and you're at work. You just want to get it done. And instead of talking about work, I started talking about my father. And it just shocked me because I was like, that is not the trajectory I was going to take. And my conversation in my head about work turned into my conversation with my father and how we weren't as close and how I had anger there and I wanted to be able to move through it. And I was given an assignment and I was told to call him and apologize for making him wrong in the narrative of the story of my life.
Wow.
I was like, I didn't come here for this. Like, I'm not the wrong one here. But talking through it and understanding that ultimately the way that you take things in is equally as helpful as how you synthesize and then make your own decisions. I remember calling my father and apologizing. And then I remember calling my mother and telling her that I went to Landmark and I completed on night one and I apologized. And my mother's response was, what the hell kind of cult are you in? Do I need to come get you? And I was like, no, it's fine. I feel great. Everything is great. I'm grateful that you are my mom and I'm grateful for everything that you've done for me and all of the things that you've sacrificed. I think this is the first time I essentially felt like a grown-up. Something about being an adult was being able to look at a situation in various ways and knowing that you didn't have to always be the victor, right? It's not about being right to be an adult. And somehow in my mind, it's like, no, you're grown. So you have to be right about these things, right? It was the basis of understanding to be able to navigate forward and understand that humans are essentially that. People are that. You are in this life, in this body, in this skin, having an experience right now. And the nature of everything that you go through is and assist you up until the point where you are to be who you are. And to think about the things that you think about and to find yourself in the experiences that you find yourself in and being mindful of that and understanding that openness and willingness to ensure that you do more work to understand versus position yourself to be correct is more powerful. And up until that point, I was very duty bound. I'm right. There's something to be said about being correct, right? I was right here. You were wrong. I mean, I'll accept your apology, but I want it to be known you were wrong. And here's how, and here's why. And then afterward, and after that, really looking at what being right gets you. Not much, you know, it doesn't do much in the way of understanding. And it certainly doesn't do much in the way of being able to learn people.
Just a matter of interest. If it was around 8 years ago, where were you at your stage in your career at that point, and did it send you in a different direction?
Or was I, my God, what I ate for breakfast yesterday? You're asking all these good questions, Mark. I don't know. I was an EA. I was an executive assistant somewhere and given more and more HR responsibilities. So it was leaning more and more into an HR role. I remember that. But knowing that the environment wasn't necessarily one that I was the most pleased with, and being really concerned about that, but also knowing both in the space of being in New York and being a young Black woman, work looks differently for me. The expectation of what work will entail will always be different for me than it would be for you. Mm-hmm. And an understanding that this is just kind of how the way things are.
I read on your site that where you said, for most people, work is a workplace, for others, it's a battlefield.
When yes.
And that really, I think it sort of made me sort of stop and really think, because I've never thought about, well, I have thought about the workplace as a bit of a battlefield when you get into internal politics and that, but not in the way that you were describing it. And it made me sort of reappraise maybe the way I've considered diversity and inclusion myself in work. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine, as you describing that, the extra layer of challenges that people have mm-hmm. face, and minorities, regardless of yeah. where you...
I mean, it's been drilled in my head from very young. I literally, my mother has probably repeated this to me 50,000 times. You must be twice as good to be seen as half as competent as someone who is white. Mm-hmm. You must over deliver whenever you give your word to something. You must be better at it than anyone else. And then and only then will you be seen as potentially on the lower level of being on par with someone who is white. You must always do a good job. Like, I hear my mother's voice in my head mm-hmm. right now. You must excel. You must prove yourself to be worthy and deemed worthy of the opportunities that people do not want to give you. There it is. You must be proven. You must prove to people that you are worthy for the opportunities that they don't want to give.
So where was it? At what point? Because you said, going back to Howard, you were studying communications and media there. But yeah. How did the sort of the pivot go from a career that could have taken you in a very different direction, and with your love of theatre, which would naturally take you into something in the creative field, you went into focus on HR. What was the driving force there?
So when I began Howard, again, I was 16 and I knew I wanted to be an actress, and I also wanted to be a reporter. So I went into broadcast communications because I wanted to be at an anchor desk. I wanted to be an anchor. I wanted to be the one that told you all the cool things and like gave the story off and then brought it back and, you know, said things, and it was cool and it was exciting. And a couple of things happened. One, the war in Iraq started, and they started actually embedding journalists in tanks. Mm. Like the actual journalist in an actual tank. I was like, nah, I want to tell the story. I don't want to be the story. That's not what I wanted to do this for. That's just awkward and odd. And no, I'm not going to put myself in that level of danger. Also, my mother would kill me. And if I died, she would resurrect me to kill me again, because I put myself in a position to die inside of a tank. What was I doing there? Very clear question. So I just knew, like, synthesis wise, I could not do it. Secondly, I discovered that I was a really strong writer. And after understanding that going into broadcast, while I was still going to continue with my degree in both broadcast and theater, that maybe being embedded wasn't what I wanted to do, I started writing, and I became the life and style editor of the school newspaper, The Hilltop. And the love of writing only grew from there. And the ability to navigate my life and college life through the written word made everything that much more rich for me. So going in, being very mindful and thoughtful about what I thought I wanted, and also coming into Howard, my thought process was that I was only going to do my freshman year there. And then when I turned 18, I would go off to another school, because Howard was my third safety school that I had selected, and I had gotten accepted to all of the other places that I had applied to. And Howard, to me, and I'm very ashamed to say this, as my third safety school, being a Black woman and having lived in Washington, D.C., there was a part of me that, one, felt I wasn't going to get anything out of the experience, right? There's no challenge if I'm surrounded by other Black people. I have to be at a predominantly white institution, PWI, to be able to compete, right? I have to go to an Ivy so I can be taken seriously. I have to. I got to Howard and I was ashamed. I was ashamed at how ignorant I was. The rich breath of history, the hallowed ancestors that have walked through the halls, the ways in which teachers take the time to ensure that they are grooming you and inspiring you to get the most, the history that you stand on. By being at Howard, I was ashamed, and I instantly understood that I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And I was so grateful to that and for that. The other thing is that September 11th happened. And there was no way in hell my mother was going to let me leave DC to go somewhere else, especially when I wanted to go to uni in New York. So apart from understanding and learning and feeling very deeply in my heart that Howard was exactly what I needed to be, 9/11 happened, and that kind of put the kibosh on me going anywhere else. And I was like, okay, I'm fine with this. Navigating through uni, thinking you know everything, because who are you if you're not going through university knowing everything? Did you actually go to school? And then getting to the end, and then realizing, and I call it my midlife crisis, even though at that time I was 19 going on 20, I became intensely aware that I hadn't left DC. And it felt like an Achilles heel. And 2 weeks before I graduated from Howard, I was born and raised in DC. I went to university in DC. If I didn't leave DC, I was going to look up. I was going to be 87 and I was going to have a good enough husband and like good enough kids, live in a good enough place and be really close to mom. And there was going to be no challenge. Right? There's going to be nothing. I wouldn't have proven myself. Like I was just going to shuffle along and I'd get a good enough job and I would have lived a decent life and no one would say that I was a failure, but no one would say that I was a success, like a huge raging. And something about that really stuck with me and sat with me. And I was like, oh my God, I have to get out of DC. Like I'm stifling. If I don't, I'm going to look up and I'm going to be unhappy. And I'm going to have like that psychotic break thing that happens to like 60-year-olds when they just like run out naked and leave their families and like start a commune in Phoenix. I don't know why that's what my head went to, but like, that's what you do, right? When you haven't lived, you have the break and you go and like you raise cattle and chickens in a RV camp somewhere where it's warm and you can wear a loincloth. Like I just went places and I was like, I have to make myself really uncomfortable and I have to prove to myself that I can do it. I have to prove to myself that I can. And somehow proving to myself meant that I needed to move to New York. No job, no plan, just needed to go to New York. And I remember having this conversation with my mother, love her. To my mother, the very methodical, stoic woman in my life, that meant I was going to take the summer, right? And think about opportunities and find a job and find a place and then move. And then I was like, nah, you know your child. I'm moving in a week. And she's like, no, you won't. Literally 3 days after I graduated, all of my worldly possessions in a U-Haul van driving up to a room share that I found on Craigslist. And this is before Craigslist had people that would kill you on it. driving all of my things and a can of paint in a van to New York.
Which part of town?
I moved to East New York because that was what I could afford with my money that I got from my graduation party and no job. And that 15 years ago is how my New York journey started. And I would do it all again. I lived in East New York. I remember the neighborhood was questionable. My mother and my grandmother would visit me and my mother would cry. And she's like, this isn't how I raised you, Jennifer. There are drug dealers outside. And I was like, whispering it doesn't make it true. Well, yes, there are drug dealers that are outside. They're very sweet to me. I also remember, and I say this rather fondly, living in East New York and that being my first like away experience and like the way it happened. I was just like, I have to get away. I have to do this for myself. New York was very much something that I had to prove to me, knowing full well that ultimately if I fall flat on my ass, I have my mother and I could always go back home. But also knowing that going back home was not an option. This had to work because this was for me and this was me being a grown up and an adult and stepping into my own. I also remember finding the ways in which the neighborhood interacted with me was so gentle and so sweet. There was definitely an element of individuals who may or may not have been doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. That wasn't neither here nor there for me.
It is New York.
But I will never forget, and I share this story fondly. I remember being maybe four blocks away from the train station, and in New York you do things late. And so I was like, yeah, I'm invincible. I'm 20. I'm going to take the train at 2 a.m. and then get off it at 4 and then walk into my apartment because why not? I'm grown. Things you wouldn't do now that I used to do. Whatever. I was young and invincible. We all have those days. And I remember one of the gentlemen that lived on the block pulled me aside one night when I was literally leaving around like 1 or 2. And he's like, Jen, I probably had a nickname of some sort. It was very clear to people that I was not from around here. He gave me a number and he's like, when you get off the train, you need to call this number so one of us can come get you. Like, so we can walk with you. I was like, yeah, okay, but whatever, sure. So I'd take the number. At this point, I probably have some sad flip cell phone, but like, whatever. Take the number, go, come back gallivanting. Obviously, I don't call. It's 5 a.m. I'm grown. It's a Friday. Everything's okay. I remember waking up the next day early, 9, to a knock on the door. It's a group of gentlemen. And the one gentleman who handed me the number is like, what did I tell you to do? And I was like, you said I was supposed to dial the number. And he's like, what didn't you do? And I was like, I didn't dial the number. And he's like, Jen, you're not from here. And we want to make sure that you're safe. Don't do that again.
I wonder if your mother had got to them.
Mark, she probably did. You know, but like, and after that, hands to God, I remember calling, and literally within 3 or 4 minutes, someone being there to walk me home. And that was my experience until I moved there. I was there for about 5 or 6 months before I moved. But I never felt safer. I never felt more protected. I never felt more seen in an environment that should have made me feel destabilized. There was a level of care that was being taken. Like, the neighborhood took care of me. And I'm grateful for that. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for that. I remember feeling that the neighborhood took care of me the way that I feel like I take care of people, because people deserve to be taken care of. I very much believe that.
Okay, we'll leave part one there. If you like the show, please subscribe and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people find us. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player to listen and subscribe. This show is an Impossible Network production and is produced by Bettina McKaylee and Elaine Castillo-Keller. But for now, be curious, be creative, and seek out serendipity. See you next time.